The good, the bad, and the alternative. By Madame Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Chapter 35. The Hunger. Eridan. Eridan stood outside the coffee house, scrolling idly through his text messages and keeping an eye out for Dave. He'd decided to dress a little bit down, casual but still stylish. He needed to make sure Dave knew that he wasn't just statement pieces like the scarf and leather jacket he'd been seen in the last two times. As such, he wore a steel-gray Klein button-down tucked into a pair of navy blue Armani chinos fashioned high around his waist with a belt. It was just a belt from Costco, but Eridan would be damned if Kirkland Signature didn't know how to make some sturdy leather. Maybe it would make him look more down-to-earth. Tucked into his waistband was one sheathed dagger, and a new addition to his everyday carry, a focus for his warlock magic. He also had a thin, light brown sweater tied over his shoulders in case it got chilly. He hoped the slits in the back that the grubs had tailored for his wings wouldn't bother Dave if he had to offer it like a proper suitor. Just as his phone's clock ticked over to 11, Kanaya's car careened up in front of the coffee house, Dave hopping out of the back seat as it skidded to a stop. "Hello, Eridan," Kanaya greeted him through the window from the passenger's seat. "We're going to find parking. You two have fun!" Vriska called from the driver's seat, grinning maniacally. Before Eridan could respond, the car peeled off in a squeal of tires, a grating laugh from Vriska, and a girlish shriek of alarm from Kanaya. "Goddamn psycho," Dave muttered, shoving his shades back up his nose and brushing the wrinkles out of his clothes. "Complaining about Kanaya's respect for the rules of the road was a mistake. She drives like Dom Toretto and his family's on the line." While he dusted himself off, Eridan took the opportunity to unabashedly check him out. Tight black jeans clung to well-defined legs, a red short-sleeved button-down putting his toned arms on display, the same red as his Converse high tops. Those shades he seemed to favor were cocked at an angle halfway down his nose, and as Eridan watched, he pushed them back, not into position over his subtly lined eyes, but up onto his head, pushing back his freshly lightened hair. Between the hair, the eyeliner, and what Eridan was pretty sure was a clear gloss on his lips, well, it was definitely stroking his ego. Those little details. Just like the fact that Dave's very pretty eyes were on display, rather than hidden away. "Hey, that was a good thing to say on a first date. Wow, your eyes are pretty tidy, Snow. Are you a middle schooler? Pick it up." "Stunning," he said, breathing out a disbelieving laugh at himself. The tips of Dave's ears turned bright red. "Oh, yeah, cool, thanks, he flapped his hands in front of his face, glancing away. "Ocular albinism," he quit his throat. You look pretty nice yourself. I'm missing that jacket, though." "Well, really?" Eridan felt a stomach drop. "I can go change." "Huh?" Dave's eyebrows knit. "Nah, I just meant..." His eyes went to the direction the car had peeled off to, then returns to Eridan. I mean, the jacket was sick, but clearly lots of stuff was good on you." Eridan felt his face warm. "Okay, then," he said, relieved. Dave nodded, glanced around, then looked upwards. "Is this the place?" he asked. Eridan followed Dave's gesture to the sign of the coffee shop. It read Black Hole in stencil font, with a stylized swirly O to look like its namesake.
"Yeah, here, let me."
Eridan stepped over to the entrance, pulling open the glass door for Dave to enter. He would have used his new magic to make them open themselves, but he decided to save his parlor tricks for when he was certain they wouldn't freak the guy out. The coffee shop had only been around for a year, but it was still leagues better than their last meeting place. Before that, Karkat and Eridan had met up at a gross little Starbucks near the airport. Its vibes had been rancid, given that it was situated in the dead center of a strip mall on a busy road, but it was the best middle ground between the houseboat and the bridge at the time. The Black Hole was much nicer, on a small road with plenty of shady trees and foot traffic, populated and staffed mostly by university students. Both he and Karkat were willing to make a longer trip for the much-improved atmosphere. Plus, it was just around the corner from multiple parks and the zoo and the Natural Science Museum. Aradia had said Dave was into dead animals, but Eridan would wager he liked alive animals well enough. Eridan followed right behind Dave into the shop, letting his date take in the eclectic atmosphere. The walls were painted a motley variety of colors and covered in modern paintings from local artists, No two pieces of furniture were the same, each table, couch, and chair looking like it was pulled from an entirely random other business, and the lighting fixtures were as equally haphazard. Erdin and Karkat's usual spot was near the window, a wooden table that belonged in a university library. One chair was of the same single-piece, heavy plastic construction typical of those in a psych ward, and the other was a cushy bar stool with sturdy metal legs. Erdin preferred the latter. Backless seats were better for his wings. The counter had chalk signs, both lining the underside and above the barista's heads, which listed their offerings. It was clearly written by a hopeful art major, as unnecessarily pretty doodles of flowers and coffee cups lined the borders.
"Erdin, hey!"
A chipper voice called from behind the counter.
"Shit,"
Erdin said under his breath. It was Alicia, waving him over, the friendly barista whom Karkatis had glanced at him often. He'd never acknowledged her overt attempts at flirtation, so hopefully she wouldn't feel betrayed or something stupid when she noticed Dave. Erdin waved back, awkwardly. Dave glanced at Erdin over his shoulder, eyebrows raised like he was posing a question.
"Yeah, I'm a regular. No big deal."
Erdin tried to play it off coolly as though he hadn't brought Dave here for the explicit purpose of wooing the boy with his social capital. He walked up and passed Dave, tilting his head for him to follow. At the register, Alicia was already glancing between the two of them, and Erdin could almost see the math equations floating around her head.
"Hi, Alicia,"
Erdin said, making an effort not to abbreviate her name, as he'd done on accident a few times.
"Hi, I didn't expect to see you today."
She smiled at him, her cat-eye glasses catching the sunlight. Erdin struggled for a response, but she went on, saving him.
"What can I get you? The usual?"
Erdin looked up at the menu, then back at Dave, who seemed to be pondering his own choice of beverage.
"I think I'll mix it up today. How about a..."
Erdin drew out his order to give Dave a few more moments to decide.
"Small golden latte with coconut milk?"
Alicia punched it into the register.
"Will that be all?"
she asked. Dave stepped up, his eyes still trained on the menu as he spoke.
"And let me get a chai with the raspberry syrup. Shaken, not stirred, extra dirty. I'm talking filthy, totally rancid with the olives, yeah?"
Alicia's smile stayed on her mouth, but left her eyes.
"So, 3 shots of espresso?"
she asked hesitantly. Dave snapped a finger gun at her. She looked to Erdin for rescue.
"Yeah, that's good,"
Erdin clarified before adding on one more thing.
"And a slice of coffee cake with 2 forks."
As soon as he said that, the math equations clicked into place in her eyes.
Oh,
she cooed, sounding much too pleasantly surprised.
"Of course."
She bashed the rest of the order into the machine, biting her lower lip. Erdin didn't like that at all. He quickly paid the $10 and herded Dave away from the counter and over to the table, feeling eyes on his back the whole time. "Dave,
what was that about?"
Dave asked quietly, taking a seat on the creepy anti-suicide chair. He briefly wondered where the hell they'd liberated the thing from, and more importantly, why.
"Oh, well, Alicia, she just..."
Erdin rolled his wrist, a contemplative look on his face.
"Likes to see new customers."
Dave shrugged, reaching up as though to push his shades up his nose, only they were on top of his head. He hastily brought it back down. A few polite comments and idle banter about recent events, Vriska, and the weather later, Dave heard the voice of the barista ring out through the coffee shop, even though there were only 4 people other than them currently in the place, all already seated with their drinks.
"I've got it,"
Erdin said quickly, gesturing for Dave to stay put. He stood, crossing to the counter with a few strides of his clawed feet. Dave swallowed as his eyes traced up from the shining talons to the siren's backside. He abruptly began recalling various facets of avian morphology, gleaned from when he cleaned and preserved a crow skeleton. He wondered if Bro had any anatomy textbooks about sirens. Erdin reached the counter, and as he grabbed the 2 cups and plate, Dave caught the barista staring at him, an odd smile on her face. Erdin turned, and Dave saw her eyes glance from him to Erdin's ass, then back to him again. She wiggled her eyebrows, and Dave suddenly realized his own eyes were no longer perpetually obscured. He immediately and pointedly started boring holes into the table with his eyes, just straight up heat vision. "What an interesting grain of wood. Is that mahogany?"
"Latte cake,"
Erdin listed off the items as he set them on the table.
"Dirty chai."
He set an oversized porcelain mug in front of Dave, which was rounding with cinnamon-dusted milk foam. Dave whistled appreciatively.
"Damn fine-looking drink."
Erdin gave a small smile. "There's a reason I come here often," he said, taking his seat again. His long fingers easily wrapped around the taller, thinner mug he'd received. Dave noted the number of rings tastefully scattered across his digits. Almost all 7 of them were gold, with only 1 silver thrown in, presumably to break the pattern. The gems were all variations of red or purple amethysts and garnets, and they glittered in a very real way. Maybe that rich dad theory wasn't so far off base as he thought. Yeah. Dave dragged his eyes back up to Aridin's face, still instinctually glancing away when his gaze was met.
No, the cashier said she didn't expect to see you today.
Aridin nodded.
I have a weekly, meeting with Kark out here. You know him, right?
Dave nodded back. Met the guy a couple times now? Seems like a solid dude. Dave was hesitant to say anything potentially hurtful about Aridin's friend. Aridin snickered.
Surprised you got that impression. Most people's first thoughts about him are, fuck, that guy's really pissed off about something.
That startled a laugh out of Dave.
Thank fuck, I don't want to talk shit and blow my chances here, but that guy will need a Snickers or something.
He needs a vacation, Aridin said knowingly, rolling his eyes to himself. Dave took a breath. Obviously, this conversation was about to pivot to the getting to know each other part. This is usually where Battleship D would start funneling all power to the ironic deflectors.
Just be your authentic self,
Kanai had said back at the shop, while shoving an eyeliner pencil into his hands. Did he even have one of those? Aridin spoke up before Dave could recall.
That's enough about my friends, he said.
What about... He was cut off, as the coffee shop's doors opened with a whoosh, and the door chime jingled loudly. Walking through the doorway was a figure whose body was entirely concealed beneath a grub, TM, sun cloak, and who was sporting a pair of extremely large, purple-tinted grandma sunglasses. Dave caught a glimpse of ratty black hair dangling from underneath the hood, and realized this was Vriska attempting to look like a common vampire. He also realized that she was wearing the pair of sunglasses Mama kept in the car for driving when it was sunny out. She abruptly stopped a foot in front of the door, sniffing the air and glancing around. She was clearly attempting to look inconspicuous, and clearly failing. She looked like a celebrity trying to dodge the paparazzi. Kanaya came in behind her, looking backwards to hold the door for the next person walking in, and bumped into Vriska, sending her staggering forward and Kanaya staggering back. Dave felt his eye twitch. He'd almost forgotten about his rescue squad, which was seeming more like a demolition squad in whatever the opposite of hindsight was. Vriska recovered from the stumble, glancing around again to see if anyone had noticed it. She caught Dave's eye and pulled down her sunglasses to give an extremely over-the-top wink that Aridin wouldn't have missed had his back not been turned to them. Thankfully, before she could offer any more subtle gestures of support, Kanaya gently pushed her towards the counter, giving Vriska a chastising scowl. Aridin cleared his throat, the only indication he noticed their entry at all being a subtle twitch in his well-groomed eyebrows.
What about you? You keep interesting company. Aside from the friends we share, obviously.
He tipped his head sideways at the counter, where it seemed like Kanaya was explaining what almond milk was to Vriska. Dave looked off to the side, blowing out a breath.
Yeah, I mean, you probably haven't gotten the best first impressions either. John, he's cool, chill. Except for movies, in which case he's kind of unhinged. I should introduce y'all properly sometime. He's kind of my main bro. Go way the fuck back, like pre-meteors and then some.
Aridin looked confused for a moment.
Oh, the winner of the rap battle, right? No, he was great. Kicked that fairy's ass. I was referring to the witch that fucking up and killed Khan.
Dave winced. Why was he thinking about John? Of course Aridin meant Rose. That was, like, the biggest fucking thing that just happened. Same with her, though. She's just been in a bad spot, you know?
I get it,
Aridin said, shrugging.
Sometimes you want to kill your loved ones. She just got embroiled in chaos magic while she was thinking it.
Dave coughed on the sip of chai he'd just taken.
You get it?
He asked incredulously, remembering how Aridin had warded off Rose with a dagger. In fact, he was pretty sure that same dagger was on Aridin's hip right now.
Cools. Been thinking about some stuff as of late. Realized I probably got a bit in common with your Rose friend, he replied.
Dave was baffled enough to stay quiet for a second. He picked up his drink and let Aridin go on.
Because, like, extenuating circumstances fucked her over. Made her express emotions she didn't want to.
Something similar occurred with me a few days ago
I already told you about that, yeah?
The breakup, the equivalent thing. Dave nodded, recalling the rooftop conversation.
And now that that's all settled, I realize we shouldn't make broad assumptions about people just for them fucking up once.
Aridin expounded, waving his hands around as he spoke.
So that's that. You didn't tell her my bad for pulling a knife on her. If you two are still talking.
For sure, I'll let her know, Dave said. He was listening, but his background thoughts were all over the place. Was this a normal kind of conversation to have on a coffee date? He'd just start rambling to ease the tension. No, bad idea. What should he say next? A joke would be good? What's in the catalog? Dicks. No, piss. Worse. Gay. Holy fuck, dude, really? I'm over that thing, by the way, Eridan said after the pause became too long. Like, all good on that front. Got a whole new lease on life, even. New lease? Dave asked. Questions. You could ask those. Questions were authentic, right? Yeah, I mean... Eridan opened his mouth, then closed it. He locked eyes with Dave, and a half-smile lighted on his face, chasing away the brief hesitation. I'm out on a date with you, aren't I? Dave felt heat crawling up his neck and looked away. Certainly a dumb smile was on his own features. You're pretty slick with those lines, huh? He half mumbled. I try. Eridan crossed his arms and leaned back, looking smug. Then he almost fell off the stool he must have forgotten was backless, his legs kicking out and his wings flaring to keep his balance. His face was ashen and his eyes wide with fear. Dave found himself, instead of laughing, placing a hand on the table and half standing, like he was about to leap into action. You good? He asked. Eridan coughed, righting himself. Yes, I'm fine. These seats, they aren't made for oats. Yeah, he said. Tom sweating, I fall over all the time. Fall off a skyscraper once, if you believe it, Dave said. Eridan smiled sheepishly. Wasn't the best first impression, was it? I mean, you could have let me die. That probably would have been worse, Dave said. True that. Eridan nodded sideways, lifting his drink to his lips. Dave watched as he closed his eyes and tipped his head back. Dave took the opportunity to glance around the shop so he could spot his carpool. He'd want to know where they were if he needed the aforediscussed bailout, but he also didn't want both his sister and Vriska to have the drop on him in a vulnerable situation. He spotted them across the shop, on a low love seat facing him. Kanaya held a paper to-go cup gingerly, and Vriska had acquired some kind of iced juice, which she was letting drip onto the coffee table in front of them, sans coaster. She seemed to be attempting to untangle something from her pockets underneath the cloak without hiking it up too far. So, Eridan reclaimed his attention. What do you like to do when you're not chilling on rooftops or falling victim to mortal danger? Dave froze. This was the moment he'd been preparing for, but he was totally unprepared. Oh, just random shit? I mean, nothing in particular? Do you? I mean, what did you do? Dave choked out. That sucked. Question sucked. Eridan raised an eyebrow. Don't say you're embarrassed now after all the inconceivable bullshit we've already gone through, he teased. Dave sucked in a little breath as his cheeks warmed. Eridan was right. What did he have to hide? A lot, an inner voice said. Thanks, he thought back. He just had to talk and stay on topic. Eridan had fucked up. He wasn't sure how or when, but Dave seemed like he was trying not to explode or something. His voice was shaky and he wouldn't look Eridan in the eye for more than a glance. It must have been him bringing up Rose. Of course Dave wouldn't have wanted to talk about the huge drama he was caught between, stupid. Eridan thought about how to recover this. If Dave was going to answer his questions with questions, he could just talk about himself, right? Maybe he could start describing the things he and Dave had in common, and that would help the guy open up. He opened his mouth to start talking about his own interests. When Dave uttered a sentence like it was a gasp. I guess I'm into all kinds of shit. I mean, you already know that me and Aradia go on archaeology digs, paleontology when we can. At least I prefer it, because it seems like half the time archaeology trips is just some dumb bastards digging up some Alabama Kushada guy's garden, which is only fun for Aradia when she scares the bastards off by saying she'll curse him. But I don't think she actually do that. Maybe she can, I don't know. Eridan's head reeled from trying to absorb that many words at once. Dave took a deep breath, then continued. Coolest thing we ever did was dug up a tiny dinosaur jawbone up by Dallas, which Aradia found, but I helped excavate and clean and shit. She wanted to let the other guys think I found it so I could put my name in a journal or something, but I'm not about that life, and definitely not about stealing credit from indigenous women of color of advanced age. Eridan had never once considered Aradia any of those words. I ain't on that colonizer wavelength. I mean, I'm half on it, kinda, because I'm half white, but like, I don't speak Tagalog or nothing, so I feel white more than half the time. I just use the race mix to win victim points online, or I used to. Queer disabled minority mixed Pacific Islander living in the reddest state in the country is pretty much a Trump card, Donald Trump style. You're fired. Damn tragedy, the media's got him. The Apprentice was fucking hilarious. Look, sorry, that was a tangent. What was I saying? Online shit? Yeah, did a ton of that.
put my mixes up on YouTube, got a turntable and a beat pad and shit, trying to put out an EP, but I don't know, that some shit ain't flowing right. I used to be real into the indie scene, but that all kind of fell the fuck apart when Motes of Society collapsed. Used to make webcomics and run a few blogs, but obviously the internet don't work no more. Makes me sad. I think some of that stuff could have been my magnum opus. I got a couple in the archives if slash when we ever get it back. I guess I could, like, try and put shit in the newspaper. Holy fuck, hang on. I gotta write that down. Hella Jeff could be the next Garfield. Dave pulled out his phone and made some kind of note to himself. I got a couple film cameras, too. I take pics of shit sometimes. Haven't had a decent subject in a while, though. It was good pickets before everything got rebuilt. Dope-ass post-apocalypse aesthetic. Kind of want to go back to that Dakwish's neighborhood. Get some shots in abandoned houses. Heard him quit his throat. Hella Jeff? Uh-huh. Dave glanced up, then back down at his phone. Sweep Road, too. Here. He turned his phone around and held it out to Aridin. On Dave's phone was an extremely grotesque and crudely drawn comic, in which two characters, which Aridin could only assume was Sweet Bro and Hella Jeff, engaged in the Charlie Brown football gag, complete with the entire peanut strip hyper-compressed in the middle of it, terminating with the red-clad man being minced by helicopter blades. Aridin nodded slowly, parsing it.
"I get it,"
Aridin said after taking another moment to think.
You do?
Dave asked, sounding genuinely surprised.
It's post-ironic. Parodying the parodies of the gag, then looping back with his shock value. Pretty avant-garde. I think some of the best human artist stuff like that. Serrano's Immersion, Duchamp's Fountain. I prefer altworks, just since they have a higher value coming from our more dynamic, individualist identities.
Altworks? I don't think I've seen anything in that. He moved his hand back and forth in the air. Genre, do you make shit? He asked. Aridin blanched.
Mike?
He twiddled his fingers, feeling lame. That was his warlock focus, but no.
Not much at all, really.
More of a creative consumer.
Word,
Dave said.
Then what are you into? Since you got me to spill, I asked Risk already, but we're having an exchange here. Plus, he seems like not up to speed on some stuff.
Aridin felt a little bit good upon hearing that Dave was interested enough to ask his friend about him.
Well, what does she tell you?
He asked.
A lot of stuff it was, honestly.
Dave kept looking behind Aridin's head, so he had to assume that's where she and Khan had set up shop.
She mentioned fashion, fishing.
His eyes fell sidelong on Aridin, appraising.
Gaming?
Aridin chuckled and shook his head. She wouldn't say that. I played a lot more before the meat years than I do now, he said.
So do you not game?
Dave squinted at him.
Not a game. It just sucks I can't play fucking multiplayer, all right?
Aridin said.
Online, that's a real shit. You can't get that stuff with a human code.
Dave's eyebrows joined his squint.
Human code, right, as opposed to fairy code. Demon code,
Aridin corrected.
Solix fucking insists he could pull some legendary game from his ass, but he's just too lazy to.
But that dude's bringing the internet back. I don't know about you, but I'd rather get every online service back than one fancy game get made.
Aridin grumbled.
You could do both if you really wanted to. Dave sipped his chai. Aridin sipped his latte.
So if you game, what do you play?
Or what did you play? Dave asked. Aridin clicked his tongue.
RTS, grind strategy, MMORPGs, Gmod, Hades, you got me remembering all kinds of stuff. There was a game going to beta right when the meteors hit. I was utterly fucking sure it was going to be my next big squeeze, called League of Legends.
What's Hades? Is that some kind of roguelike?
What? No, like the god.
Oh, okay, sure.
You play any of that?
Aridin asked back.
I mostly play stuff on my Xbox.
Dave's mouth twitched down.
Tried World of Warcraft once, because John Rose and Jay were trying to start some kind of guild, but we didn't even get 10 members. Probably since nobody wanted in on a guild run by a bunch of 13-year-olds.
Aridin laughed at that. It reminded him of a few of his own multiplayer misadventures. Kanaya.
What are they talking about now?
Kanaya whispered. Aridin is talking about the time we raided that TF2 community server and really pissed off the dudes who owned it.
You remember that? They were doing some weird elaborate roleplay thing with custom maps, and we were so annoying we literally ran most of the regulars out of the place.
Viska grinned at the memory.
They couldn't keep us out because we were connecting through the alternet.
Ah yes, didn't we all get VAC banned for that little misadventure?
Kanaya replied, nodding in recollection.
Viska waved her hands dismissively. No, we got it appealed after like 6 months. It was totally lame. The mods sucked. By the time the punishment was over, we'd all moved on to something else.
She took a sip of her drink, then frowned.
Wait, can you really not hear any of this?
Kanaya shook her head.
As I said, it appears I have utterly failed to attain any real level of advanced sensory abilities. Beyond smelling blood, of course.
She tilted her cup at Vriska.
I appreciate you topping off my drink, by the way. I never imagined blood and rooibos could possibly mix well. Briscoe winked. I'm full of good ideas, just you wait, she said flirtatiously. Can I have blushed?
Yes.
She cleared her throat. Honestly, I was expecting we might be called to assist by now by either party. Especially after Dave showed off his comic. I don't think I've shown you the thing, but it is the definition of acquired taste. She was a fan of Dave's traditional sketchwork, but his more creative digital pieces were visually grating, with the intensity of the colors. Terezi would probably love them. Briska snorted. Eridan is an acquired taste. Hell, some people would say I am too. She rolled her eyes, moving as though to flip her hair before realizing she was still wearing the hood. But that just means it takes a distinguished palate to appreciate us. I bet Eridan is super smug that Dave wanted to show him his raw, unfiltered whatever. Kanaya shot a glance at the boys. Neither of them seemed distressed, both leaning in and looking rather engaged by each other's words. Raw and unfiltered indeed. Eridan hasn't started talking politics yet, has he? She was a tad nervous that he'd say something horribly offensive. It was why she'd never introduced them. She reached for a spoon, stirring her tea for a moment, dredging up the blood from where it had sunk like honey. In the naturally red rooibos, it might have been mistaken for honey by a casual observer. She took a sip of her tea, eyes slipping shut as the ribbons of blood danced over her tongue, and gentle like a caress. Eridan's explaining his and Feferi's shared computer setup in the seaside shack they used to sneak away to, and he's getting a bit less awkward each time he references her. Kanaya hummed, taking another sweet sip before lowering the cup, eyes fluttering open as she replied, "Ah, that is the trouble. With how much of his life was wrapped up in hers, I'm surprised he's able to discuss his past at all." Yeah, well, now he's talking about how they were the only alts in that town because it was too close to Siren territory for anyone else to dare. So politics might be just around the corner, Briska warned. Eridan. There's like 5 different kinds of aquatic or semi-aquatic, whatever, water-happy alt groups in Houston at least. You tell me the area you lived in was literally called the Sea of Monsters, but no other alts would dare go to a town you only hung out in when you wanted to use the capture net?
Dave asked, brows raised.
Eridan nodded. They know better than to stray too close to an apex predator's roost. Dave didn't look like he bought it, so he continued. See, us sirens are kind of like top dogs in the entire alt pyramid, not just compared to other sea folk. What about my vamps? Dave asked. Seems like they have a checkmate in most situations. His face went grim for a moment. Haha, you'd think that, Eridan said, waggling a finger. But seeing as they can't deal with bodies of water and rain, they really can only operate in a tiny bit of land. That's why they're desert vampires. But sirens, we can fly anywhere. Land, sea, mountains, forests, seas. Most of the earth is fucking ocean, see? For emphasis, he extended his wings, causing some teenage idiot to yelp in alarm and scramble out of the way. I could spend literal months in the air. If I want to, I'll be swooping down to get a snack if need be. Vamps are just as vulnerable to the song as anyone, really, and I've got way more of a range than they do. A solid blow to the head from my talons while they're stumbling in a daze will put them down quick enough. He grinned. Me and Vris stated ourselves when designing claws in armor. So I've already won the debate with her about power levels. He paused, suddenly unsure. What did you know about CNA? Oh yeah, your custom war game, right? Dave said. You can't tell me you're not an artist and totally fail to mention you designed a whole tabletop game. Now she's got to be hella creative, right? Eridan preened a little, pleasantly surprised by the compliment. Well, it's a bit on the technical side. I didn't think it would really merit a mention compared to spinning your own music and running a webcomic. It's the same level of world-building as a novel, I guess, Dave said. Okay, so where do dragons fit on the power scale? Because when I heard they were real, I thought they'd top out the chart, and I was really fucking impressed us humans had never managed to spot an airplane-sized lizard, but then I met Terezi and was like, damn, she's basically the size of a really mean purse dog, you know? But shit, I've heard a few rat terriers can take down a bear if they work together. So maybe even a purse dragon should be fucked with. And besides, she also just shakes you down for quarters if the bridge troll's busy, so it's better just hand over the money and not find out. Dave paused. Shit, sorry, I was rambling again. My mouth just runs away from me sometimes. He took a sheepish sip of his drink. Eridan chuckled, trying to put him at ease. It's fine, I followed you well enough. Right, so, dragons, Res is a baby, by her standards. She won't get to the size you're thinking of until she reaches her first millennia. It makes it really hard to scale for gaming purposes, plus they're notoriously reclusive after a certain point. Asking me if I beat her in a fight is a whole different beast than pitting me against the worm, you know? He drummed his fingers on the table, remembering his mid-air encounter with Razzy back when he was so fucking pissed he could barely fly straight. Being that small, it makes her pretty fucking nimble. I think a yappy dog is an apt comparison. But all it would really take is a solid swipe of my talons, and pretty much anyone I'd hit would do massive damage. She'd have a better chance if she dive-bombed me and then shifted human, trying to force us both to the ground, but I'm still confident I could take her down. He took a sip of his drink. We didn't even start the big ones, to be honest. They were like trying to start a god. And gods don't really do mortal wars, or live in seaside fishing villages. Dave nodded as he absorbed the information. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, what about some of the other winged people, like fairies? That Tavros dude looked pretty yoked for a butterfly. Erden frowned, trying not to start mentally comparing his own physique to the Fey man. The Fey still need weapons for combat, and even if they dual wield, it's only dual. I've got natural weapons plus dual wield. I dropped my daggers in aerial combat, and I still got my talons. If he dropped his spear, then he either goes on the defensive or risks putting his wings toward me as he dives after it. Plus, Fey magic has all sorts of weird rules. It can't be whipped out as a weapon the same way the song could. I guess he could try to kill you. Dude has some freaky looking needle teeth, but shit, I can't imagine that going well. Dave hummed and thought. What about Gamzee? The guy turns into basically anything. He could probably just be a siren if he needed to duke it out with you. Shapeshifters must be pretty high on the list, right? Shit, that was a good point. But Erden was damned if he was going to let his hypothetical self get beaten in a fight by Gamzee of all people. Stalling, he took a moment to sip at his drink, then cleared his throat. Yeah, shapeshifters, doppelgangers, whatever you want to call them, they can emulate anything that's real. And plenty of shit it's not. But they can't copy magical abilities, just physical features. I think I'd get the upper hand with the song. It might knock him out of whatever sort of concentration he uses to hold himself together. You ever see him do that flesh puddle thing? I've seen it. Haunts my fucking nightmares on occasion. Dave shook his head. Yeah, my best guess is if the song took him, he might start melting or something. Enough that he wouldn't be able to hold functional wings together at least. They'll give me the upper hand. Enough that hanging around in my space wouldn't be worth it for him. Erden honestly wasn't sure what could kill a doppelganger, as they made no logical sense. He was glad he'd never actually encountered one while defending his territory, because with their seemingly endless ability to bounce back, he might have ended up in a fight until his own exhaustion brought him down, but there was no way he was going to say that. All right, you sold me. Sirens are OP. Dave. Dave couldn't help the next question he blurted out. Where do humans factor in? He winced, but finished the thought. Your game adds alts to human wars, right? So you gotta have a counter for, like, knights and samurai and SEAL team shit, yeah? Erden raised his brows. I'm gonna freak you out if I tell you that. He did that thing where he grinned a bit too wide, pulling his lips back enough that his teeth were on display. It's not a fair contest, according to the natural order. Dave caught his attention, focusing a bit too much on his date's teeth. He nodded, trying to act natural. Right, I get it. You're plucking sailors out of the rigging and busting skulls on the rocks and shit like that, but the dudes in combat are going to be armed, on guard. That makes some sort of difference, right? He thought of Bro in the clearing, but bringing up hunters sounded like the worst possible idea. Well, if we're talking about scenarios now, like within the game, I say, of course, it's pretty significant. Erden toned down the smile, looking thoughtful. Preparing troops with earplugs can do a lot of damage to a Cyberman unit's capabilities, and it's impossible to advance on a prepared firearm formation on the wing. There's no cover in the sky, just got to remember, any weapons a human will have access to, so will any other alt. It's part of the self-fulfilling balance. So humans factor into the victory by just holding ground and being prepared? Dave asked. It's warfare, isn't it? He said. Everything is about territory control. On top of that, one special creature doesn't win the day. And there are fucking lots of you all. If there's one thing humans win at, it's fucking war. Compound the average sovereign and the average human, no contest. Compound the Zeus-blotted empire of mankind, all the damn weapons you built to kill each other, and the couple thousand sirens kicking around the Mediterranean. Well, we can only song one person at a time. His eyes turned downcast as he said that, and Dave felt some strange need to comfort him. Well, it's not like all humankind is under one banner. We're always fucking with each other's shit all the time, always. Can turn on the radio right now and guarantee some dickhead is still going off about the Jewish plot to destroy American values, he said. Erden laughed and nodded. Same with alts, too. Real fucking hard to get people to see the upsides of unity, even when there's a pamphlet right in their face about it. Weird metaphor, Dave thought, but sure. Some comfortable silence lapsed. Dave took a few more bites of the coffee cake, appreciating the crunch of the brown sugar. And a thought crossed his mind. Is it weird for you to go on a date with someone you could eat? He asked. Erden's eye twitched, and Dave immediately backpedaled. I mean, holy shit, that was a bad question. I'm fucking sorry, you do not have to answer that. Oh, wow. He smacked himself in the forehead. I don't think so, Erden said quietly, looking at him with smoldering intensity. It makes me feel like I want to protect you. I don't just have some insatiable hunger that could tear into you at any second. It's just like, Imagine you were on a date with someone who looked totally like any other person. Except you knew they were made of Big Macs.
That bitch ain't making it out of the coffee shop alive, Dave said flatly.
Eridan started laughing hard and even snorted.
That made Dave laugh too, but he did wonder.
John
was glad that they were meditating with their eyes open now, because he was pretty sure the magic in his chest refused to reach out to the stupid candle, and trying to sense it through his closed eyes yesterday had given him a headache. At least now he could be sure he was getting nowhere, without feeling like he was cheating by looking at it. The longer he sat there, the more his attention and his eyes tended to wander. At least he wasn't alone, though. He spotted Rose in a meditation pose, watching Feferi through narrowed eyes, like she was trying not to get caught. Feferi herself seemed to be receiving some sort of guided instruction, Dr. Lalonde telling her to make herself angry or happy, and seeing how the water responded. The thin needles of ice some emotions were forming were stacked in a pile on her mat, seemingly unable to melt. The ice had a weirdly glowy effect, a pinkish-purple halo, the purple edges strangely dark, like maybe he was seeing ultraviolet light. The light didn't seem to affect anything around it, so he was pretty sure it wasn't really there. It must have only been visible in his true sight. He didn't seem to be able to turn that display of magic off, but John wasn't able to really do anything with it, except get distracted by all the little magic he was suddenly aware of. Feferi's light show, for example. The colors made him think of a field trip from middle school, when they visited the Seattle Aquarium. Everyone wanted a turn at the touch tank, and John had wandered over to the jellyfish exhibit in the same room instead of waiting in line. The weird little blobs undulated in the water, their translucent bells revealing strange shapes glowing inside, pinkish purple or blue. John had wanted to go back to the aquarium at some point. Their translucent bells revealing strange shapes glowing inside, pinkish purple or blue. John had wanted to go back to the aquarium at some point. It kind of sucked to realize that the place was definitely destroyed. He tried not to think about stuff like that too much. There were so many places he'd been that wouldn't have survived. John's gaze drifted towards Jade, his thoughts drifting with him. Jade's island was gone now, sunken beneath the waves like so many others. He'd been so certain these past 3 years that Jade was still out there. He'd been right, obviously, but it seemed kind of crazy when he thought about it now. Jade was fine, basically unscathed compared to Vriska, but it hadn't been a sure thing. She had a scar from the plane crash, a crash she clearly should have died in. John was immensely grateful for Beck, for his last-minute save. Speaking of Beck, he was sitting on his yoga mat, seemingly content to watch Jade as she moved around the room. Jade was already done with her meditation and was setting some stuff up that hinted at a far more exciting turn of events. As he watched, she was lining up some training dummies into rows, each one staggered so there weren't any dummies directly behind each other.
"Jonathan, are you having some trouble?"
Dr. Lalonde asked, drawing his attention as he sheepishly nodded.
"Yeah, sorry, I can't seem to focus," he gestured at Jade. "If I can't get my magic to go to the candle, am I not allowed to do whatever is going to happen next?"
"Oh, not at all,"
Dr. Lalonde reassured him.
"In fact, I've been monitoring you, and I'm quite sure that you could use a little shake-up in your mode of instruction."
She winked at him cheerily.
"None of this inner tranquility stuff comes naturally, but that doesn't mean you're doomed. We'll make a superhero out of you yet, I assure you."
John knew she was trying to help, but between getting mind-controlled by the bad guy and his inability to summon his magic, he wasn't feeling very superheroic at all. More like the kind of idiot who thought he was a hero and turned out to be a major liability.
"If you say so."
He tried not to seem ungrateful, but he was pretty sure that came out sullen. Whoops.
"Does that mean I can blow this out?"
"Yes, go ahead."
Dr. Lalonde waved dismissively at the candle.
"I'd do it for you, but that's really not the spirit of the exercise."
Right.
He blew out the candle, then stood up, shaking out his legs. They were a bit stiff from being in the cross-leg position for so long.
"So now what?"
"Jade set up one of those dummies for you. She's going to teach you how to throw a proper punch. The rest of them are for projectiles. She and Feferi can use those."
Dr. Lalonde gestured at Feferi, and the girl grabbed her freaky icicles and stood as well.
"John, you go join your cousin. I'll be helping Feferi get set up."
He nodded at her. As she turned, Rose got up as well, picking up her notebook and pen as she did so. She walked over to John, a sympathetic smile on her face.
"I'm certain you'll achieve this, John. You've only just started, after all," she said, giving his shoulder a pat.
He appreciated the gesture, given that it would have been easier for her to reach his head.
"Thanks, I'm sure I'll get it too. It's just kind of embarrassing,"
he admitted, rubbing his neck. The pursuit of magic sees fit to humiliate its adherents sometimes, Rose said all too knowingly. But at least you can be certain it's somewhere there within you. John nodded. The magic was within him. Thanks, Rose. I'll try to give you something interesting to write down, he said, sincerely meaning it. She giggled. I appreciate it immensely, John. Good luck, she said, and went to take a spectating seat to the dummy practice. John made his way over to Jade, who now stood in front of one of the dummies. It was in the first row, all the way over to the left, far enough away from the others that it probably wouldn't be near the ones Feferi would be throwing ice at, which was a relief. Just looking at those things made his head hurt a little bit.
Hey, John!
Jade greeted him warmly. Beck barked a hello as well.
You ready to learn some fisticuffs?
She grinned, pushing up imaginary sleeves, she was in a tank top, and rolling her fists at him. He wasn't sure if she was emulating a video game character, or maybe her grandpa. Her dad. John scratched the back of his head sheepishly. Shooting a glance at Dad, he shot John a thumbs up, then returns to his laptop. I kind of always thought Dad would teach me this, because he's all about those manly milestones, you know, but he's too much of a gentleman for that, I think. Jade patted his shoulder. Don't worry, little cousin. I can teach him too if you want. I bet Grant would think it was absolutely smashing of me if I gave his nephew some pointers. She put on her old man voice for a moment there, grinning and giving him a dramatic wink. John felt the hint of a smile as he imagined Jade trying to teach Dad how to throw a punch. I don't think Dad is actually interested in rough and tumble stuff. He cracked his knuckles because that seemed like the right thing to do. All the macho dudes in the movies did it. But I am. How do I do this? He scooted directly in front of the dummy, putting up both his fists and tossing a few air punches at its chest. Jade laughed.
Definitely not like that.
She gestured for John to step back from the dummy.
I'd tell you to tip up your hands first, but I think we'll just avoid any high impacts to start off.
Boo, John jeered quietly. Jade rolled her eyes.
You might be indestructible, but taping your hands ensures your fist is a rock-solid weapon when you throw a punch. I'll teach you some other time. For now, you need to learn a proper stance.
She dropped into a fighting stance, facing John in an instant.
Like so,
she said. Her left hand was out far, basically fully extended, and her right hand was lurking closer to her torso like a coiled snake. Her head was tilted so her chin was at her collarbone, but her eyes were locked on John's with an odd intensity. Her legs were wide, her left foot forward and her right foot back, bouncing on the balls of her feet, and shifting her weight back and forth.
This is called long guard,
Jade said, extending her lead arm forward and back intermittently, like she was gauging distance.
You hear the same term in sword fighting. It's basically the best way to start a fight. Putting as much distance between you and your opponent as possible. What about this?
John brought his fists up to his eye level and close to his face.
This is how you see all the boxers guarding.
That's their traditional guard. It's good, like really good for boxing, but that's when your hands are covered in big protective gloves. If you block hits with your bare hands braced against your head, you'll just get your fingers damaged. So, John peeked out from behind his raised fists. What you're saying is it would be perfect for someone who's invincible. Jade squinted at him and scratched her nose.
Just do the long guard, she commanded.
John smiled at her and lowered his hands, doing his best to mirror her stance. Jade stood upright and walked around to John, analyzing him.
Stay off your heels, bring your guard up. Tuck your chin. Further.
She rapidly corrected his stance.
This doesn't feel like I'm winning,
John said, his voice impeded by his jaw being pressed to his chest.
It doesn't matter how you feel,
Jade said with an unnatural tone that made it sound like she was reciting something.
When it comes to life or death, you fall to the level of your training.
Jeez, John said.
Sorry, it's just that you have to keep your head this low when you're in danger of getting hit. Your jaw is your weak spot. You can keep your head up when you're further out, which you should be if you're in long guard.
Jade quickly clarified. She tapped her chin, looking John up and down. Staying on the balls of his feet was the hardest part for now. It reminded him of the brief time he tried gymnastics and how he utterly failed at being graceful or balanced. He liked the solidity of his heels.
All right, that's good. Now you can throw a punch,
Jade said.
Sweet.
John sprung his right hand forward from where it was hovering near his chest. It felt awkward with such a wide stance.
But not with that hand.
Jade stepped in front of John and took up the guard.
You're going to learn how to jab first.
Her left hand came back a bit as she bounced. Then she took a lightning quick step with her left leg and threw a short, fast little punch with her lead fist.
But that's so tiny, John said. The jab?
Jade bounced her lead leg back and forth, throwing a punch every other step.
It's the most important punch in your toolbox. It's how you keep someone at bay, it's how you measure your distance, and it's not weak in the slightest. I would tape your other arm behind your back to teach you how important it is, but you need to learn to keep your guard up at the same time.
Jade let out little hissing breaths of air with each punch. He watched her rhythmic, repeated punches flow like a perfect machine, an unbroken cycle.
Okay, John nodded. Show me how to do that.
Uh-huh. John felt a drop of sweat run down his face, like it was fleeing Pompeii. He'd been throwing this same punch for what felt like an hour straight now. He almost missed the meditation. Every time he thought he was about to reach that perfect cycle he'd seen Jade in, she stepped in and introduced a new wrinkle that threw it out of whack. Jab, lean back, repeat, jab, duck, repeat, jab, circle around, repeat. His arm was on fire from staying raised so long. He couldn't even pay attention to what Fafario Dad was doing at this point. There was just him and the dumb, silicon-molded face of this dummy. He focused on the rhythm of his breathing, timing the exhales with the steps and the jabs to keep his oxygen levels high enough to avoid passing out. Jab, breathe, duck, etc. At some point, Jade had told him that a jab was also called one in the context of the five of the basic punches. It made him think of math class, of endless series and factorials, which made him think about coding. He started trying to think of the exercise as a for loop, each iteration modifying its variable based on the count. It helped him ignore his whining muscles. One, circle around, breathe, iterate, I, by plus one. One, lean, breathe. The thump of his fist, softly impacting the dummy, became a rhythm to match a processor speed. Thwap, one, duck, breathe, iterate, thwap, one, circle, breathe, iterate. One, breathe, iterate. His arm burned. One, breathe, iterate. He felt it through his entire body. One, breathe, iterate. The perfect cycle. The rush of adrenaline filled his mind. John wondered if it was some kind of runner's high. Thwap, thwap, thwap. His body was practically moving on its own. He thought back to the failure at the candle. The flame unflinching no matter how hard he focused. It didn't matter, there was fire within him, like Rose said. That wasn't lactic acid burning his muscles, that was fire, baby. One, 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 one.
John!
He heard a voice cry out. He whipped his head around.
Huh?
He asked. Jade was running over to him. Concern, but also excitement, tightening her brows, her mouth uncertain what shape to take. Dad had stood, and was making his way over to John, parental concern all over his face. John was also standing, eyes wide. She locked eyes with John and pointed at his dummy with her pen. John glanced back to see a ring of fist marks had been seared into the rubber around the dummy's chest, releasing an acrid smell into the lab air. He looked down at his hands, and his left hand, shaky as it was covered in a fading blue sheen of magic.
Whoa!
He looked up at Jade, then back to his hand, then back to Jade.
Whoa!
Jade beamed at him. Dad walked up behind her and crossed his arms, marveling at the dummy. Across the way, holding her collection of icicles, the fairy applauded cheerfully with the backs of her hands.
You did it! You used magic!
Jade laughed, squeezing him in a tight hug.
I was starting to worry I'd be the only one in the family that could.
Looks like you're gonna have to share some of the inheritance.
John grinned at Dad over his shoulder.
That's really something!
Dad exclaimed as Jade released John.
Say, son, you know with great power, Tad.
John groaned at the trope. Dad chuckled and raised his hands as if to say, got me. John heard heels clacking on the floor behind him and turned to see the doctor appraising his handiwork.
A fire punch, she said, tone somewhere between delight and derision. Very video game.
He smiled.
What were you expecting?
He asked sincerely.
It sounded like you knew the physical training would do something the meditation wouldn't.
Behind her, John saw Rose readying her pen over a page of her notebook, listening intently.
Honestly, I thought it would just alleviate some of your excess energy levels so you could get back to the meditation, but this is much better, she said. Though maybe we'll get you a metal dummy for any future incidents of this.
She waved a hand in front of her nose at the burning rubber smell.
Lunch while the lab airs out, anyone?
Aqueous. Thumbing through the pages of Hauntings in Houston, Aqueous reclined at the conversation pit, listening to the soothingly familiar scratches of Nepeta's color pencils against her sketchbook. Unable to arrange a rendezvous with Jay just yet, his partner decided to refresh her old art of the girl's original warrior character, and the whole thing had spiraled into a very intensive drawing session. Last time he had checked, Nepeta was reproducing what he was pretty sure was a memory of this past full moon, with her own original warrior character drawn in the place of her actual feline form. The thought of the moon drew his attention back to the page, where Alvaraz was discussing the major conflicts between the Red Wolfwares, the undisputed primary claimants to this area's moon, and the various minority wares that constantly nipped at their heels, usually coyotes, but sometimes of the more feline persuasion.
Nepeta, a thought just occurred to me.
Aqueous broke the silence, drawing a distracted,
huh?
From Nepeta in turn.
How much contact do you have with the other wares of Houston? Do the canines ever cause trouble for you on the night of the full moon?
Nepeta's pencil stopped its motion against the sketchbook as she paused and thought. He looked over at her, watching her close her eyes and scrunch up her nose, presumably trying to sort through her moon-touched memories.
"My territory is in the marshlands," she said. "I'm pretty sure the werewolves want a drier forest, so I just keep to their shore." She shrugged. "I don't even see them on my way out of this city, which makes me think they don't leave on foot."
Equus nodded slowly.
"I suppose that makes sense. The Red Wolves appear to be a long-established pack. It's possible they commute to some private land far enough away that they don't need to worry about wandering back into town during the night."
Nepeta grimaced.
"I don't know how they do it, so many of them together in one territory. It sounds so crowded."
Equus looked back at his book.
"Well, it appears the same group of last names tend to feature in all the important events. So perhaps it's really the Bloodkin who hunts together."
"Bloodkin are overrated,"
Nepeta muttered. She shot him a sheepish glance.
"Nothing against your father, I mean more," she gestured vaguely. "It's just her and the moon, okay? The lioness is one with the world, and every sliver of moonlight bathes it in a blessing made just for her. It would be tainting the beauty of it to involve anyone else."
Equus raised his brows at her.
"Well, you're a solitary creature. You can't even tell me the name of your dam, nor how many littermates you had. Canines are pack creatures. Perhaps the moon sings to them differently."
"Perhaps. But why were you asking about them anyway?"
"Well, according to my book, it appears that there have been times when the Red Wolves of Houston have gone so far as to slaughter the pups, kits, and cubs of anyone else who dared to bask in their moonlight. It's quite gruesome."
Equus tapped the page in question, tilting it such that Nepeta could take a closer look.
"I bet the vampires do the same thing," she mused. "There's not a lot of Whiskers species in this area, you know. It's probably intentional."
Equus felt a jolt of nerves at the assertion. The book had yet to discuss the vampire population in any meaningful capacity, but given that the author was a vampire herself, it was possible some degree of bias would color her descriptions of those conflicts as opposed to that of the moon-touched.
"Are you saying Vriska might be in danger from the locals?
If you think I might be in danger from the dogs, why shouldn't she be in danger from the shadow dwellers?"
Nepeta pointed out.
"It's the same territorial silliness you're worried about, right? Because, unlike your people, there isn't one singular united nation of wares or vamps. With all the different species of wares and vamps, the very idea would be impossible to manage."
"I suppose that's correct,"
he nodded slowly.
"I've often wondered that your unconventional rearing has caused you to be disconnected from a cultural or ethnic identity. But your aversion to the idea of running in a pride would cause strain if you were to be forcibly brought into the fold of some greater structure."
"Right, exactly. It's not like I'm a coyote or grey wolf and could be first to assimilate into the Red Wolf Pack's underclass, and they know it. Maybe they did kill my species in the past, but so few of us are found together that I bet it was mostly other dogs they had the biggest problem with. More competition from an actual rival pack than a solitary lion."
"Well, you've gone these 3 years unmolested," he murmured. "And the obvious lack of a Tom following you around presumably assuages any concerns about a significant dynasty of lions attempting to gain a foothold."
Nepeta snorted.
"Who needs a Tom when I can have a stallion?"
She winked at him, and he flushed at the compliment.
"But you're right. I'm clearly not planning to have kits. So long as Vriska doesn't start setting up a temple and looking for converts, I'd hope the common vamps would ignore her."
Equus was immensely satisfied that Nepeta didn't mind the way his thoughts tended to stray toward Vriska recently, even as he discussed her own safety. She was very accommodating of his various responsibilities, including the informal ones, such as this.
"Then hopefully she can focus on hiding from her own people rather than that of the local population as well."
Speaking of responsibilities,
"I just remembered. I forgot to inform Father that Vriska has already run into a member of Sakett's kingdom in Houston, to update him on the situation."
"Shouldn't he have been texting you with updates? Last you talked to him, things were getting really intense out there, right?"
Nepeta was drawing little idle shapes now, some monotonous pattern of leaves that indicated her attention was rather more focused on the conversation than her art.
"He did seem rather stressed when we last spoke by phone. I suppose I assumed he was simply too busy to spend much time communicating with me."
He grabbed his phone from where it lay abandoned on a cushion.
"I also thought he might be allowing me some time to settle, seeing as things have been rather hectic here as well."
He took a moment to scroll through their recent messages. The last text was one he did not recall sending. Presumably, Nepeta had made the decision to send his father several photos of the party, including the open waltz. There had been a short reply informing him that the grandmothers were pleased to see him wearing their beadwork, and that the results were rather regal.
Equius was quite certain that the compliment being centered on regality was evidence the praise came from his father, not that he was acting as mere messenger. It was quite nice to hear. As he typed a short summary explaining the nature of Riska's encounter, he spoke.
Petra, I do worry about this turn of events. Riska said the woman recognized her face, and Riska's not precisely identical to her mother. That means the attacker must have been close enough to the nobility to actually see Riska.
Or that the pharaoh shared a photo of her with other searchers, Nepeta pointed out. I bet there's wanted posters and everything.
Equius nodded. That is a good point, but humor me. If they know her, then it stands to reason that they would search for her companions. They might believe we are hiding her. And I do mean us specifically. It will be quickly evident who I am, and thus my relative value was leveraged against her compared to the rest of our group. Given that they have taken my cousins, it's quite likely they know of your relative value as well.
He'd been pondering this. If the vampire scans John's recent memories, a centaur in full regalia would stand out even compared to the more eclectic attendees.
If she was able to search John's memories, then she will know how to find our home.
And now he'd reached the crux of the matter.
I see.
Nepeta shot a glance at the windows, the curtains tucked out of the way to allow the light to stream into the room. It was a nice view of the side yard and the wild area beyond the cul-de-sac, but not useful for assessing threats on their front stoop.
Should we be setting up traps?
He furrowed his brow.
What do you mean, traps?
Dunno, spike pitch or something? She shrugged.
It worked for us once before, didn't it?
Equius paused, suppressing a shudder as the eerie cry of a long-forgotten monster rang out of his blood-splattered memories.
That was different. We were luring our target to a pre-selected clearing. Fortifying a house is another matter entirely.
Didn't Riska's grow up with spike pits around her home, though? He shook himself out of his memories and snorted in amusement, understanding clicking into place.
Spike pits of that nature for protecting castles, unfortunately. I don't believe our home has enough of a defensive wall to qualify as such.
He paused, then added.
Unfortunately, they wouldn't be much use against a vampiric assailant, as I'm sure they could execute a long jump and clear the obstacle.
He reached over and patted her shoulder.
I commend you for the idea, however.
He hoped that didn't sound too dismissive. The house simply wasn't suited to resist a siege. Nepeta darted after his retreating wrist to give him a parting kiss, then sighed.
Darn. Then what? Do you think Pollux could give us some sort of demonic protection?
He hadn't considered that, actually.
That's an interesting notion. I suppose we could ask him. But I was thinking more about defensive measures for you, actually.
He hastily cut her off. He already knew what she'd say.
I know you have that dinged-up old knife you carry around to compensate for the weeks without claws. It served you well, but is perhaps more suited to wilderness survival than regular combat.
He tried not to disparage her favorite blade, but the thing was an affront to weapons everywhere. It was battered, barely sharp, stained with rust and various fluids, and made of an inferior metal. It was nearly impossible to get it apart with the darn thing.
I killed three hunters with it, she protested. It has never failed me. While killing poachers is commendable, they're only human. You're going to need something of a stronger caliber if you're going to be at risk of ambush by the Pharaoh's soldiers.
Speaking of which, he really ought to be carrying his crossbow around the house. It wouldn't do him much good all the way in the garage.
Maybe she sent her diplomatic corps,
Nepeta muttered sullenly.
Then they can talk as well as fight. That does not mean we shouldn't prepare ourselves for the worst. Your current blade is rather short. What if you take a swipe and find your wrist caught in the fangs of the assailant?
The very thought made his tail twitch nervously.
Then I'd be close enough to his face to stab it,
Nepeta informed him. This did not quell his rising anxiety. He started fiddling with his hair.
Before the venom numbed your fingers and caused your blade to drop from your limp grasp, he pointed out. I'm not talking about a hunter's sword here, just something that gives you a bit more reach. I'm not giving up my knife, she said stubbornly.
Equius paused.
I am simply suggesting you acquire a second knife. You can wear it on your other hip.
I'm not wearing my knife right now, she pointed out.
Well, yes, but you really should start. And I should be wearing my crossbow.
Motivated, he closed the book, standing up.
In fact, I think we should assess your combat skills. When was the last time you had to tussle someone in the waning phase?
Equius, you're not calling me rusty, are you? She looked up at him, eyes narrowed. He swallowed nervously.
Skills, like a blade, can never be too sharp. I simply would like to assist in the honing of yours.
With a sigh, Nepeta put down his sketchbook and stood as well.
If it'll make you feel better, I suppose we could spar just a bit. With a longer knife?
He asked hopefully, stepping out of the pit and dangling towards the garage. He knew just which knife to bring her.
Let me show you what I can do with my knife first, okay?
Nepeta said, heading towards the bedroom.
Grab my bow, too. We can do some target practice after.
Excellent idea, he called after her. I only hope our friends are taking the danger seriously as well.
For the full text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Madam Melon Meow and Sarcastic Celery. Constant Conquest by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at sangabrielvo.com. And there you can learn about other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.